Hello, and welcome back to the Perspectives in History podcast. I'm your host, Willem Kahn. Thank you for listening, as always. This is part 7 of our series on the Korean War, entitled No Substitute for Victory. Well, I'm back a little over 2 weeks from the last episode, like I promised. I'll avoid rambling on about housekeeping this time around, since you probably know the deal by now. All I'll say on the matter is that work on the rest of the script is progressing along well, and with any luck, I'll have the rest of this series uploaded by April. No promises, though. Anyway, without further ado, let's begin. We covered quite a bit of subject matter in the previous episode, but to briefly recap, we picked up our narrative around the end of October 1950. For the soldiers fighting under the United Nations banner in Korea, total victory seemed tantalizingly close. Their superiors were telling them that they would be home by Christmas that year, and they had every reason to believe that this would in fact be the case. So when the UN troops made first contact with the soldiers of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army in the northernmost reaches of the Korean Peninsula in the final days of October, their superiors in Tokyo and Washington, D.C. refused to believe that the worst-case scenario had come to pass. For them, the possibility of foreign intervention on behalf of North Korea had been deemed unlikely. They rationalized that the Chinese had only sent a token force into Korea to serve as a deterrent, likely around 30,000 men at most. What they did not know, or perhaps refused to see, was that several times that number, 250,000 Chinese troops, had infiltrated the country in the preceding weeks. Spirits were still high a month later when Commander-in-Chief of the UNC, General Douglas MacArthur, initiated the Home by Christmas offensive, intending to finish establishing control over the north and wrapping up combat operations as quickly as possible. Then, on the evening of November 25th, disaster struck, attacking the U.S. 8th Army at its position along the Chongcheon River in the northwest. The PVA took the enemy by surprise and inflicted heavy losses, not only succeeding in halting the UN advance, but compelling the 8th Army to begin a full retreat, ultimately causing them to withdraw from North Korea entirely, back across the 38th parallel. To the east, the PVA also engaged elements of 10th Corps, the other smaller formation of UNC troops in North Korea. Despite being heavily outnumbered and cut off from Allied units, the 1st Marine Division carried out a fighting retreat 78 miles southeast to the port city of Hungnam. Against the odds, they managed to maintain their cohesion as a unit while withstanding over 2 weeks of near-constant enemy assaults and the bitterly cold North Korean climate in what has gone down in history as the most famous battle of the Korean War, the Battle of the Chosun Reservoir, also called the Battle of Lake Changjin. In the third week of December, the survivors of this battle were evacuated by ship from Hungnam to Busan on the peninsula's southern coast, along with the other divisions of 10th Corps, several thousand tons worth of equipment and supplies, and nearly 100,000 Korean refugees. So that brings us about to where we left off previously. In the last episode, I held back from doing a final discussion of the Battle of the Chosun Reservoir, so at the top of this episode, I'd like to discuss a few aspects of that subject in particular. Specifically, the strategic objectives of each side going into the battle, whether or not either managed to achieve said objectives, and how the battle affected the strategic situation of the war overall. Then, we'll talk a bit about how this particular battle is remembered in both the United States and China. To start this discussion, I will say that despite the fact that the Battle of the Chosun Reservoir / Lake Changjin is the single most famous event of the Korean War, the question of who won this battle, so to speak, is not an easy one to answer, with historians being divided on the issue. In my view, both sides could claim victory there, and not unreasonably so. For the Chinese, the results were mixed. On one hand, they had driven the enemy from the battlefield and forced them to retreat all the way to Busan, inflicting heavy losses on them in the process. While the withdrawal did not put the Americans and South Koreans in quite as desperate a situation as they found themselves in around July or August of 1950, it did enable the Chinese to reclaim the northeastern portion of North Korea. On the other hand, though, General Peng Dehuai's intention had been to encircle and completely destroy the 1st Marine Division, and hopefully do the same to at least one other division of 10th Corps before they could withdraw. In this objective, the Chinese had failed. More importantly, they had suffered heavy losses themselves. The official number provided by the People's Liberation Army Logistics Department puts Chinese casualties at Lake Changjin at 52,098. Of these, less than half, only 21,366, were recorded as combat casualties. The remaining 30,732 non-combat casualties can be attributed both to the harsh weather conditions and a lack of adequate food. If we assume that the Ninth Army's on-paper strength of 120,000 was more or less accurate, this puts the PVA's casualty rate at Lake Changjin at 43%, which was a bit lower than that of the enemy if only the forces engaged at Lake Changjin are taken into account. More on that in a minute. Now, obviously, suffering this many casualties in one battle is not an ideal outcome, but the PVA, unlike their opponents, had a larger base of manpower that was easier for them to draw from, meaning that they could sustain losses like these and continue to prosecute the war. However, the losses suffered by the PVA during the Battle of Lake Changjin did diminish its fighting capacity in the immediate term. The Ninth Army was knocked out of commission for the next 3 months, and two of its divisions had been so badly decimated that they were forced to disband. Captain Wang Shuizong, a PVA officer from whom I quoted last episode, offered his own strategic assessment of the battle from the Chinese perspective. Quote, "We were forced to give up our hard pursuit of the enemy. We had our own problem. First, we were unable to pursue the retreating Yuan forces because of our unmotorized infantry and our lack of supplies. The 26th Corps delayed their movement because they had to wait for food and ammunition. We initially thought that we could requisition grain from the local Koreans and salvage ammunition from abandoned enemy positions, but we were wrong. The area around the chosen reservoir was very lightly populated and incapable of feeding a large force of over 100,000 men. Secondly, the men of the Ninth Army, who were mainly from southern China, were not prepared for a cold winter battle in North Korea. The army suffered more than 40,000 casualties during its first battle, from November 17th to December 21st, 1950. Half of these casualties were from frostbite. For the next 3 months, the entire Ninth Army group became a giant field hospital for its wounded and severely frostbitten soldiers. As a result, the Ninth Army was effectively disabled and unable to fight in another major engagement until late spring the next year. Third, as the PVA began to strike southward, the tactics of divide, encircle, and destroy had begun to lose effectiveness. Although successful at first, the UN forces managed to rapidly adjust to these tactics. Also, as our supply lines became extended, the damage to our logistical efforts by UN airstrikes became increasingly heavy. For all these reasons, the Ninth Army drove the 10th Corps south of the 38th parallel, but fell short of the original plan of annihilating it entirely." End quote. I feel like that summarizes the outcome of the battle from the Chinese perspective rather succinctly, so let's move on to discuss the American side of things. To begin with, I'll try to answer the same question that I did for the other side, that being, can the Americans reasonably claim victory in this battle? An American claim to victory at the Battle of the Chosin Reservoir is as fraught as the Chinese claim, but a case can still be made. When the battle first broke out on November 27th, the strategic objectives of the 1st Marine Division and the remainder of the 10th Corps were the same as they had been for all other UN forces in Korea at that moment: total occupation of the North, the elimination of remaining communist forces, and the eventual reunification of the Korean Peninsula under the Republic of Korea. These goals had ceased to be realistic once the PVA launched its second phase offensive, and from that moment forward, the sole priority of 10th Corps became preventing their complete encirclement and destruction. It is difficult to determine at what point exactly the decision was made to evacuate the 10th Corps by sea from the north, with some sources claiming that it was as late as December 8th. Whatever the case may be, in this mission the UN forces succeeded, and the battle can be considered a victory by this metric. The fact that the 1st Marine Division had been able to maintain its cohesion as a unit during the battle was a highly significant factor in the mission's success, something acknowledged by General Oliver P. Smith in an interview he later gave to the New York Times. Quote, "They knew about us all right, where we were and what we had, but I can't understand their tactics. Instead of hitting us with everything they had at one place, they kept hitting us at different places. If the Chinese had decided to knock out the small marine garrison at Harago Reef first, the task of regrouping our forces into a full division would have been made immeasurably more difficult." End quote. Of course, the success of the Marines' mission had come at a high cost. 17,833 casualties, to be precise. While this is a considerably lower number than the Chinese casualty figure, the losses suffered by the Americans proportional to the number of men engaged in the battle were, by comparison, more severe, a casualty rate of nearly 60%. However, when one takes into account the strength of 10th Corps as a whole, the casualties at Chosin represented only 19% of the Corps' total strength. Had the division been completely destroyed, replacing them would have likely proven difficult. In terms of the effect that the losses at Chosin had on the fighting capacity of 10th Corps, only the 1st Marine Division was taken out of commission for an extended period of time, returning to active combat duty during Operation Killer, a UN counteroffensive in late February and early March 1951 that we will hopefully cover next episode. As for the others, the 3rd and 7th U.S. Infantry Divisions and the 1st and 3rd ROK Army Divisions, they were able to be redeployed within a matter of days and played a critical role in eventually halting the PVA and KPA's advance southward by mid-1951. This task, obviously, would have been made several degrees more difficult had General Peng's initial plan succeeded. Some historians have drawn parallels between the evacuation at Hung Nam to the evacuation of Dunkirk during the Second World War, in that both operations were immense logistical undertakings, the success of which saved a large proportion of the Allied military from near certain destruction and was therefore able to fight another day. As the single most famous battle of the Korean War, both Americans and Chinese have been keen to claim victory, to glamorize the efforts of their soldiers and often to disregard the wider context of the war. I'll have a lot more to say about the cultural memory surrounding the Korean War as a whole and this battle in particular in the final episode of this series, but if there is one point about the Battle of Chosin Reservoir / Lake Changjin that I want to emphasize, it is that the results of the battle were ambiguous. Either side could make a reasonable claim to at least a partial victory, and considering the fact that the war itself would result in a stalemate that remains unresolved to this day, the same could also be said of the Korean War as a whole. Anyway, with that discussion out of the way, let's return to our main narrative. To say that news of China's intervention in Korea had come as a great shock to the American public would perhaps be underselling it. Naturally, this turn of events drew comparisons to the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor 10 years prior, and there are some similarities to be found. Both were surprise attacks against the American military carried out by previously neutral East Asian powers, unaccompanied by a formal declaration of war. Both of these events also resulted in heavy losses of men and materiel for the United States, and carried grave strategic implications going forward. But the crucial difference between these two events is that while the attack on Pearl Harbor had stoked widespread outrage and galvanized the American public for total war against Japan, the reaction to the Chinese intervention in Korea was far more muted, as an article appearing in Time magazine later that year reported, quote, "The nation received the fearful news from Korea with a strange-seeming calmness. It was the kind of fearful, half-believing matter-of-factness with which many a man has reacted to learning that he has cancer or tuberculosis. Unlike Pearl Harbor, which peeled out like a ball of fire, the numbing facts of the defeat in Korea seeped into the American consciousness slowly. Days passed before it became apparent that the UN forces had met with a crushing defeat. The disaster and its implications became the subject of endless shocked conversations. Some of them were almost monosyllabic, with men meeting on the street, sometimes staring at each other, and then voiced the week's oft-repeated phrase, 'It looks bad, very bad.'" End quote. Naturally, people were looking for someone to blame for this catastrophe, and their sights landed on General MacArthur. With the benefit of hindsight, many of his decisions, such as authorizing American troops to march all the way to the Yalu, ordering bombing raids against targets near the Chinese border, even crossing the 38th parallel in the first place, now appeared to be reckless and impulsive. The hot-headed general had dragged the United States into war against communist China and the entire world to the brink of a new global conflict. MacArthur struggled to defend himself against such criticism. In a statement written to the New York Times in the final days of November, he attempted to justify his actions, quote, "Every strategic and tactical movement made by the United Nations Command has been in compliance with the directives under which I operate. It is inaccurate to attribute any degree of responsibility for the onslaught of the Chinese Communist armies to the strategic course of the campaign itself." End quote. In another press statement made a short time later, the general went even further, deflecting the blame onto the Truman administration and the Joint Chiefs of Staff by characterizing the restrictions that they placed on his authority in Korea as, quote, "an enormous handicap, without precedent in all of history," end quote. President Harry Truman was irate, later writing in his memoirs that he, quote, "should have relieved General MacArthur of his command right then and there," end quote. At the time, however, he refrained from such an action. The truth of the matter was that all parties involved, including the president himself, held some degree of responsibility for this debacle. Truman, for his part, never blamed MacArthur personally for the defeats suffered by the UN forces in Korea, at least not outright. Nonetheless, he did blame the general for, quote, "the manner in which he tried to excuse his failure. He alone was unable to deal with the defeat in dignity and good grace," end quote. MacArthur had to be reprimanded for making such inflammatory public statements. On December 5th, Truman issued a directive to all officials of the departments and agencies of the executive branch. The first of these directives required any and all public statements issued by government personnel, both military and civilian, to be first cleared by the State Department. The second directive strongly encouraged all such personnel to, quote, exercise extreme caution in public statements and to refrain from direct communication on military or foreign policy matters with American media publications, end quote. Despite the semi-vague language employed here, it was obvious to whom these directives were directed. In his briefing sent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on November 28th, MacArthur grimly reported, quote, "We face an entirely new war. The ultimate objective of Chinese forces is undoubtedly a decisive effort aimed at the complete destruction of all United Nations forces in Korea. It is quite evident that our present strength of forces is not sufficient to meet the threat posed by the Chinese. This command has done everything humanly possible within its capabilities to address this situation, but is now faced with conditions beyond its control." End quote. No one disputed the claim that the nature of the conflict had changed irrevocably. Drastic measures had to be taken, but it soon became apparent that assigning blame for the situation in Korea was one matter, while reaching a consensus regarding a new course of action was quite another entirely. The whole American political and military apparatus had been thrown into a crisis of indecision from which it was not easy to emerge. Broadly speaking, there were three options that lay open to them, none of which were ideal solutions to the problem that they now faced. For one, there were some who proposed responding to China's actions in a highly aggressive manner. That is to say, by effectively declaring open war against China. Some of the specific measures that were proposed included fully blockading the coast of the mainland, destroying China's war industries by means of aerial bombardment, and directly assisting the nationalist government in Taiwan to attack the Chinese mainland. Of course, such actions as these ran the risk of drawing the United States and its allies into a war with the Soviet Union as well. The implications of a state of open war existing between two states armed with atomic weapons should be obvious. For this very reason, this course of action was ruled out by State Department officials fairly early on. Those who supported escalating the war, at least in the manner just described, were generally President Truman's political opponents in the Republican Party. The most prominent voice in favor of escalation was, by far, General MacArthur, whose increasingly vitriolic criticism of Truman's handling of the war would eventually lead to his dismissal. On the exact opposite end of the spectrum, there were some who advocated disengaging completely. They argued that the strategic value of Korea was not equivalent or greater than the losses that the UN forces would suffer if the war was to be prolonged much further. It would be better for the US and its allies to simply cut their losses and withdraw entirely. This point of view was far less widespread than the one previously described, and despite the fact that contingency plans for such a scenario had been in fact drafted in the days and weeks prior, there was a general consensus that a withdrawal from Korea would be an immense blow to American prestige, and therefore should be avoided at all costs. Then there was a third option, which lay between the two polar opposites. While the balance of forces in Korea now meant that achieving total victory was no longer feasible, the prospect of pulling out entirely was, to many, every bit as unthinkable. This was certainly the opinion of diplomat George Kennan, a key advisor to Secretary of State Dean Acheson. In a letter written to Acheson on December 3rd, Kennan argued eloquently for the administration to take a level-headed and rational course of action. Quote, "Dear Mr. Secretary, there is one thing I would like to say in continuation of our discussion yesterday evening. In international as in private life, what counts most is not really what happens to someone, but how he bears what happens to him. For this reason, almost everything depends from here on out on the manner in which we Americans bear what is unquestionably a major failure and disaster to our national fortunes. If we accept it with candor, with dignity, with the resolve to absorb its lessons and to make it good by redoubled and determined effort, starting all over again if necessary along the pattern of Pearl Harbor, we need lose neither our self-confidence nor our allies nor our bargaining power. But if we try to conceal from our own people and from our allies the full measure of our misfortune, or permit ourselves to seek relief in any reactions of blunder, petulance, or hysteria, we can easily find this crisis resolving itself into an irreparable deterioration of our world position and of our confidence in ourselves." End quote. The Secretary of State was quite moved by Kennan's letter, so much so that he read it aloud to his fellow State Department officials the following day. He then offered his own thoughts on the matter. Quote, "The Korea campaign has been cursed by violent swings of exuberant optimism and the deepest depression and despair. What is needed now is dogged determination to find a place to hold and to fight the Chinese to a standstill, end quote. Acheson communicated these sentiments to President Truman and Secretary of Defense George Marshall and found both of them receptive. The president reaffirmed that he had, quote, no patience for the suggestion that we abandon Korea. We will stay and fight as long as possible, end quote. With the prospect of total victory no longer realistic and the prospect of total defeat deemed too costly, Truman's statement more or less summarizes the course of action that the United States would commit itself to in Korea going forward. On the military side of things, the UNC would attempt to halt the communist advance near the 38th parallel, while on the diplomatic side of things, the US would seek to arrange a ceasefire in Korea, ideally returning to the pre-war boundaries until a more permanent solution could be realized. In early December 1950, American diplomats began to put out feelers to determine on what terms the Chinese would be willing to agree to an armistice. Their terms, as they soon discovered, were far stiffer than the officials in Washington, D.C. were willing to agree to. On December 16th, China's representative to the United Nations, Wu Xiuquan, announced that his government would agree to a ceasefire only under the following conditions. 1. The withdrawal of all foreign troops, including Chinese, from Korea. 2. The withdrawal of all U.S. military forces from the Strait of Taiwan. And 3. For the People's Republic of China to be included in the negotiations that were already underway in San Francisco to formally conclude the war with Japan. It is unclear whether Wu or his superior, Foreign Minister Chou Enlai, expected to reach an agreement with the United States at this time or not. Based on Chairman Mao's disposition and the current strategic situation, it's likely that the Chinese terms were deliberately formulated so as to be unacceptable to the Americans, thus giving the Chinese a pretext to continue offensive operations when their terms were inevitably rejected. This is precisely what ended up happening. Acheson commented that the first and third terms, that is, the withdrawal of foreign troops and the inclusion of the PRC in negotiations with Japan, while unpalatable, were potentially acceptable. But as for the second, it was a complete non-starter. The Cold War mindset had become too deeply entrenched in Washington, D.C., for anyone to even contemplate abandoning Taiwan. Outside of the United States, however, not everyone agreed that Taiwan was too high of a price to pay for peace in Korea. In any event, it was clear that reaching a ceasefire agreement, at this time, was not possible. For continuity's sake, I think it's worth reminding you of the time frame here. The offer of a ceasefire was first extended to the Chinese on December 11th. At this time, UN forces in Korea were still very much in disarray. The 8th Army had only just reached the 38th parallel a few days prior, and the evacuation of 10th Corps from Hungnam was still in its early stages. In other words, the situation was still very much in flux, and would remain that way well into the following year. The Communists had the advantage, and to outside observers, there was no indication that they were going to stop their southward advance anytime soon. George Kennan, the diplomat whose letter to Dean Acheson I quoted from a bit ago, argued that the current conditions were not conducive to negotiations. The UN had to launch a counterattack, or otherwise demonstrate their military capabilities to the enemy so that they could negotiate from a position of equal or greater strength. For the time being, the UN forces would have to keep fighting. Seeking to countersignal the defeatist message coming from MacArthur's headquarters in Tokyo, the President and Secretary of State made an effort to project a sense of confidence to the public. At a White House press conference held on November 30th, shortly after news of China's intervention reached the United States, President Truman stated, quote, "The mission of UN forces in Korea is to repulse the communist aggression that threatens not only the fabric of the United Nations, but all human hopes of peace and justice. We shall intensify our efforts to help the other free nations of the world increase their defenses in order to meet the threat of aggression everywhere. We shall rapidly increase our own military strength as well. We are fighting in Korea for our own national security and survival. The United States will take whatever steps are necessary to meet the military situation," end quote. This statement prompted a reporter to inquire as to whether or not whatever steps necessary included the use of atomic weapons. Truman replied that the U.S. would use all the weapons at its disposal. The reporter once more pressed him on the question, inquiring specifically as to the atomic bomb. Evidently, Truman was not prepared to answer this question directly. His response was, quote, "There has always been active consideration of its use, but I don't want to see it used. It is a terrible weapon," end quote. When asked if the use of atomic weapons would be subject to UN approval, Truman stated that, quote, "Ordinarily, responsibility for the use of weapons rests with the field commander," end quote. Needless to say, Truman's response here did not inspire confidence either at home or abroad. The White House press secretary was quick to issue a statement clarifying that only the president could authorize the use of the atomic bomb, and that at this time no such authorization had been given. However, this did not fully alleviate the concerns of America's allies in the UN coalition, the United Kingdom chief among them. There was a lively debate in the British House of Commons the evening after Truman's press conference. Taking to the floor, opposition leader R.A. Butler stated, quote, "I want to come immediately to some circumstances which have arisen this evening and which have caused many of us great concern and anxiety. I want to express, at any rate on my own behalf, and I believe on behalf of a great many other honorable members, my very great disquiet, the horror that many of us would feel at the use of this weapon in circumstances which were not such that our own moral conscience was satisfied that there was simply no other alternative." End quote. Prime Minister Clement Attlee wholeheartedly concurred with Butler's statement, and at the end of the session, he announced his intention to fly to Washington, D.C., to meet personally with the American president as soon as possible. Up to this point, the United Kingdom has not featured very prominently in this narrative. Although the Suez Crisis of 1956 is considered by historians to mark the definitive end of the UK as a global superpower, the British Empire had already been on the decline for quite some time already, at least since World War II. For all intents and purposes, Britain was a junior partner within the US-led anti-communist bloc that emerged in the wake of the war. Still, despite the loss of some significant overseas holdings, such as India, the British were undoubtedly the second most powerful anti-communist power on the globe. The UK and the Commonwealth nations, former colonies that remained in close voluntary association with Britain, contributed over 100,000 military personnel to the UN war effort. Diplomatically, Prime Minister Attlee was acting as the unofficial spokesperson of not only Britain, but of these Commonwealth nations, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa. Additionally, other European members of the UN coalition, such as France and the Netherlands, expressed similar concerns and coordinated with the British Foreign Office in advance of Attlee's state visit. All parties agreed that the United States must be urged to show restraint regarding the situation in Korea, especially when it came to the use of the atomic bomb. Reporting from London, American journalist Howard K. Smith claimed that Attlee represented the opinion of the greater part of the non-communist world, and that he was, quote, "a man of at least temporary power equal to the Earth's Big Two, Truman and Stalin," end quote. Smith emphasized the weight of the British Prime Minister's mission and suggested that the issues at stake went beyond just the question of the bomb. He wrote that Attlee was, quote, "being propelled across the Atlantic by one of the most amazing political upheavals in Europe since the war, a rebellion of all free Europe against the kind of leadership that America was giving to the West on the Korean issue," end quote. The British delegation arrived in Washington, D.C. on December 4th, and the subsequent talks unfolded over the course of the next 4 days. Top British diplomats and members of the British Military High Command also participated in the discussions, but for the most part, Attlee himself took the lead. On the American side of things, President Truman, while present for most of the proceedings, allowed Acheson to do most of the talking on his behalf. The first item on the agenda was, of course, the atom bomb. In short order, Attlee was able to extract from the Americans a promise that, quote, "the alarm over the safety of our troops would not drive them to some ill-considered use of atomic weapons," end quote. With that matter settled, the topic turned to what some historians consider to be the true purpose of his visit. Essentially, what Attlee wanted was to bring an end to the conflict in Korea as soon as possible, and furthermore to ensure that until such time, the scale of the conflict would remain confined strictly to the Korean Peninsula. America's European allies were concerned that the war in Asia was preventing the U.S. from taking active security measures against the communist threat in Europe. Former British Prime Minister Winston Churchill said as much during a debate in Parliament, quote, "the United Nations should avoid by every means in their power becoming entangled inextricably in a war with China. The sooner that this Far Eastern diversion can be brought to something like a static condition and stabilized, the better it will be for us. For it is in Europe that the world's cause will be decided. It is here where the mortal danger lies," end quote. In order to get the Chinese to agree to a ceasefire along the 38th parallel, Attlee proposed removing Taiwan from the UN Security Council and offering Red China admission to the UN in its place. The position of the UN in Korea was so precarious, Attlee argued, that cutting Taiwan loose may be well worth the blow that it would strike to America's national prestige, to say nothing of the geopolitical ramifications. Acheson firmly disagreed. The United States could not negotiate with the communist powers of the world from a position of weakness. He maintained that the only way to halt the spread of communism was to actively fight against it. Therefore, it was absolutely necessary that the UN coalition continue to fight in Korea until the communists indicated that they would be willing to agree to a ceasefire without demanding that concessions be made elsewhere, especially as it regarded Taiwan. If even this was not possible and the UN forces had no other choice but to pull out of Korea entirely, then so be it. Again, there were contingency plans in place for such a scenario. But, as the Secretary of State put it, quote, "To cut, run, and abandon the whole enterprise is not acceptable conduct. There is a great difference between being forced out and getting out," end quote. Ultimately, this issue came down to a divergence between American and British leadership regarding their geopolitical strategy in Asia, which in turn stemmed from differing interpretations of China's national interests. Attlee claimed that China had intervened in Korea primarily because of the threat that a total UN/ROK victory posed to their own national security. It would be a mistake, he argued, to view communist China as being little more than just another satellite state of the USSR. An agreement along these lines, he believed, was every bit as undesirable to Beijing as it was to London and Washington. If a policy of rapprochement with communist China was pursued, it may even be possible to effect a split between the Soviets and the Chinese, and to establish Red China as a counterbalance to Soviet ambitions in the Far East. Acheson saw things differently. He maintained that China's decision-making had been entirely motivated by their ideology, and as such, they were taking direction from Moscow. For all intents and purposes, China and the Soviet Union, and by extension North Korea, should be treated as one political entity. Attempting to appease China by offering up Taiwan for a settlement in Korea would not gain the US and the UK an ally in China, but could only undermine their position elsewhere in Asia. Ultimately, the status of Britain as a junior partner within the coalition meant that they largely had to acquiesce to the United States leadership. In the final communique produced by these negotiations, both parties expressed their willingness to end the conflict in Korea through negotiation with China, and to continue to cooperate with each other both diplomatically and militarily until such time as an armistice could be realized. More importantly, they acknowledged that complete Korean unification under the ROK was no longer a feasible goal, and this was dropped as their objective in the country. The disagreements regarding Taiwan and the wider divergence of foreign policy in East Asia were, for the time being, simply papered over. As to the other pressing question of the moment, the atomic bomb, Truman had agreed to, quote, "keep the Prime Minister informed of any and all developments that might lead to its usage," end quote. This was short of what Attlee had wanted, which was an agreement by Truman not to use atomic weapons without first consulting the British government, but for the time being, this arrangement worked just fine for both parties involved. In the end, both Attlee and Truman were able to walk away from their talks, satisfied that the Anglo-American alliance remained as strong as ever, and with strengthened resolve to confront the situation in Korea. Speaking of which, we've spent quite enough time talking about the state of affairs on the American home front, so it's time for us to return to Korea and discuss the communist side of things. If you will recall from earlier, when the Chinese People's Volunteer Army launched its second phase offensive in the final days of November 1950, UN forces in Korea had been concentrated into two different contingents, the 10th Corps in the east and the 8th Army in the west. And although the Chinese ran into difficulty in executing the eastern prong of their operation, getting bogged down in a lengthy battle with the 1st Marine Division for the better part of 15 whole days, events moved much more quickly in the west. Following a relatively short clash along the Chongchon River, the entire US 8th Army was sent into a full retreat, running headlong for the 38th parallel. The decision was made to abandon the DPRK capital of Pyongyang without a fight, with the last UN troops evacuating the city by December 5th. As US Army Private Billy Mossman recounted, quote, "much of the city was ablaze by 7:30 a.m. on December 5th, when the rear guards destroyed the last bridges over the Taedong River and set off the final demolition charges in the section of Pyongyang south of the river," end quote. Chinese and North Korean forces entered the city the following day, and the liberation of the DPRK's capital was proclaimed. Kim Il-sung and other top government officials made their triumphal return to Pyongyang the next week. On December 12th, Kim addressed the city's remaining inhabitants from the balcony of the city hall. Just 6 weeks prior, Syngman Rhee had stood at this very same spot and declared that the Korean nation, soon to be reunited, would never again be divided. Now, Kim delivered a similar message, assuring the people that with China's intervention, the end of the war was close at hand. Quote, "Final victory lays ahead, but we must not allow the enemy any breathing space. The chance to build new lines of defense and the chance to reorganize its troops. The guerrillas must carry out more activity south of the 38th parallel so that not a single enemy can be allowed to escape, end quote. He concluded with a new slogan, March South. As enthusiastic as the North Koreans may have been at the prospect of reunifying the country, General Peng did not share their optimism. He was painfully aware of the fact that further offensive operations were not possible in the immediate term, given the current state of the army's logistics. The PVA had already outrun its supply lines, resulting in critical shortages of food and clothing, which may very well have been the deciding factor at the Battle of Lake Changjin. General Nie Rongzhen, who acted as a sort of liaison between Beijing and the PVA's field headquarters, later summarized the issue in his memoirs, quote, "During the second offensive campaign, we had originally planned that two armies plus two divisions would be able to handle the campaign's responsibility in the western sector of the advance. But because we couldn't transport the required amounts of rations to the front, we were forced to cancel the extra two divisions. In the eastern sector, the troops which entered Korea had not made sufficient preparations and faced even greater difficulties. Not only did these troops not have enough to eat, their winter uniforms were too thin and could not protect their bodies from the cold. As a result, there occurred a large number of non-combat casualties. If we hadn't had these logistical problems, as well as certain other issues, the soldiers would have easily been able to wipe out the U.S. 1st Marine Division at the Changjin Reservoir." End quote. In the last episode, I promised to provide a more comprehensive overview of the PVA's logistics during the war, since these issues would continue to characterize the Chinese war effort throughout the entire duration of the conflict. Compared to the Americans, the Chinese were at a severe logistical disadvantage from the very beginning. While the Americans could use automobiles, aircraft, and sometimes even trains, the Chinese were severely limited in their ability to transport soldiers, equipment, and supplies to the front, both on account of their reduced industrial capacity and the enemy's air superiority. General Nie, who is very familiar with the state of the army's logistics, later stated, quote, "Transportation, trains and motorized transport and the like, was extremely difficult to provide, if not impossible, throughout the war." End quote. Because of this, the PVA was forced to rely on more antiquated methods of transportation, namely human and animal labor. For these purposes, the Chinese employed the use of a wide variety of pack animals: horses, donkeys, mules, oxen, and even camels. The PVA even maintained entire units of horse cavalry during the war, which is remarkable considering that most militaries had phased out the use of their horse cavalry around the time of World War I. That said, the Chinese mainly used their mounted troops for reconnaissance purposes rather than the mass charges that characterized cavalry tactics in past eras. Anyway, returning to the subject at hand, the use of human labor to transport supplies was similarly efficient to the use of animals, and even more so according to some estimates. U.S. intelligence officer Donald Nichols was of this opinion, remarking that the use of human porters was the enemy's quote-unquote secret weapon. Indeed, the use of human and animal labor for the purposes of military logistics did have a number of advantages. For one, because it largely lacked motorized equipment, the PVA did not require large quantities of fuel, petroleum, gasoline, etc. Secondly, and more importantly, porters and pack animals were usually able to move supplies while avoiding detection by reconnaissance aircraft, hence why the PVA's entry into Korea had gone unnoticed for as long as it did. As the war dragged on, the Chinese became even more adept at using camouflage to conceal the movement of their troops and supplies. Nichols was quite impressed by their abilities to, quote, "make it so that everything blended in with the environment. In many cases, you could not detect their equipment and/or personnel until you were within a few feet of them," end quote. Of course, there were drawbacks as well. Humans and animals aren't able to carry loads as heavy as vehicles designed explicitly for the purpose of transporting cargo. Moreover, as living beings, they were liable to become fatigued or ill, or to die. Both humans and animals also required food in order to perform their functions, which also had to be transported from rear areas, as the desolate North Korean countryside afforded scant few opportunities for foraging. As I said previously, logistical problems continued to plague the PVA throughout the war. Said problems would be most acutely felt during the earliest phases of China's intervention, roughly from November 1950 until spring of the following year. This was due to a few different factors. For one, the Chinese were initially unfamiliar with the area. Secondly, the harsh winter conditions previously described at length placed heavier strains on supply lines as the PVA struggled to get winter clothing to the front in sufficient quantities. Thirdly, the front was highly fluid at this time, and even though the PVA held the initiative, they were not able to sustain offensive operations for much longer than a few days at a time, lest they outrun their supply lines. As the war continued, however, these factors became less critical. The Chinese soldiers gained a familiarity with the region's geography and learned how to use it to their advantage. The winter of 1950 to 1951 would prove abnormally severe as weather conditions improved drastically, and the eventual stabilization of the front precluded the possibility of the army advancing too far ahead of its supply lines. In any event, the constant threat of aerial bombardment was something the Chinese could never fully overcome, and may have been the only thing that stood between them and a total victory. As historian Max Hastings argues, quote, "Probably the most critical contribution of American air power in the Korean War was the interdiction of supply routes during the winter battles of 1950. This alone prevented the Chinese from turning the defeat of the UN forces into their complete destruction." End quote. Again, with all this in mind, the PVA's logistics were still in a state of disarray as of December 1950. And yet during this time, there was immense pressure on General Peng Dehuai, not only from the North Koreans, but also from his own superiors in Beijing, to press the attack. Even before the second phase offensive had begun, there was quite a bit of discussion among the Chinese, North Korean, and Soviet officials as to their next move. Principally, they faced the same question that the UN had faced after the Battle of Incheon, that being whether or not to push beyond the 38th parallel. While the leadership of each country had their own nation's interests in mind when it came to the conflict, all parties were generally inclined to press their advantage and pursue total reunification if possible. The North Koreans themselves were the most vocal in this regard. Kim Il-sung paid a visit to Beijing in early December to urge the Chinese leadership to, quote, "not allow the enemy any time to breathe," end quote. Certainly, Chairman Mao maintained that the communists should pursue an aggressive strategy in the immediate term. The day after his meeting with Kim, he sent a message to his field commanders, including Peng, that read as follows, quote, "The People's Republic of China will negotiate only when the enemy agrees to withdraw south across the 38th parallel, and then to withdraw from Korea entirely. It is most advantageous that we seize Pyongyang and Seoul, and we will mainly aim at eliminating the enemy strength, beginning with wiping out the ROK forces. In doing so, we will be in a much stronger position to compel the United States imperialists to withdraw from Korea," end quote. The chairman was concerned that if he failed to press the advantage now, there was the potential for the conflict to stall out and become far more costly in the long term. On the other hand, the PVA's field commanders, General Peng chief among them, and even some of his advisors at home, including Army Chief of Staff Nie Rongjian, urged patience. In the midst of these debates, a very promising intelligence report had reached Beijing. It indicated that the U.S. Army's Chief of Staff, General J. Lawton Collins, believed that, quote, "given the current speed and scope of the Chinese and North Korean attack, and given the great losses the Americans have suffered in troops and morale, the United States is in no position to put up a long-term defense on the peninsula," end quote. The report also claimed that preparations were being made to abandon Seoul, and that ships were being assembled at Busan for a seaborne evacuation. This intel was seemingly supported by reports that had appeared in the South Korean and Japanese media around this time, but as it would turn out, this was not accurate. Collins had indeed visited Japan and South Korea recently, and his initial assessment of the situation was along the lines of what the report claimed, but after consulting with MacArthur and the commanders in the field, it was resolved that the UN forces should try to make a stand north of Seoul. Nonetheless, Mao interpreted this information as proof that the communists could win the war in short order if they immediately went on the attack. With this in mind, Mao ordered Peng to proceed south of the 38th parallel on December 13th. Peng was hesitant given the state of the army's logistics, but complied with the order. Still, he sent a lengthy telegram to Beijing explaining his reservations on December 19th, quote, "Given this most recent victory, the spirits of the Korean party, government, military, and people, as well as the prestige of the Chinese People's Volunteer Army, are high. However, expectations of quick victory and blind optimism are widespread. The Soviet ambassador says that UN forces are attempting to escape and that we must pursue them. In my view, the war in Korea will be fairly long and difficult. If the enemy shifts from the offensive to the defensive, shortens the battlefield, concentrates troops, and narrows the front, the situation will become advantageous to combined arms operations. The morale of the American and puppet troops has fallen, but the enemy still has about 260,000 men under arms. On the political side of things, it would be very disadvantageous to them to abandon Korea immediately. Britain and France are not yet asking America to do that. Even if the enemy suffers one or two more defeats and a few more of their divisions are eliminated, they still may withdraw and defend several bridgeheads, such as Busan, Incheon, and Kunsan. A complete and immediate withdrawal can hardly be counted on. At present, our forces must advance cautiously." End quote. In his response 2 days later, Mao stated that while he did not completely disagree with what Peng had said, it was still of the utmost importance to cross the 38th parallel before they could be convinced to agree to a ceasefire on less than favorable terms. Once they had managed to establish a foothold south of the parallel, it would then be possible for the troops to rest and regroup. After some further correspondence, a compromise was reached. The PVA would strike south of the 38th parallel once they were physically able to do so. Mao gave Peng until the beginning of January to renew offensive operations. Ideally, they would be able to recapture Seoul, but this would not be their top priority. Once sufficient progress had been made, the army would be permitted a longer time to rest before launching the decisive offensive that Mao anticipated would deal the final blow to UN forces in Korea. Meanwhile, in the south, the ROK government reacted to this recent string of setbacks, particularly the fall of Pyongyang, in much the way they'd reacted to the initial outbreak of the war. That is to say, by massively ramping up political repression and the executions of suspected dissidents, with this renewed round of state-sanctioned violence being similarly bloody to the one that had preceded it. A report in the London Times claimed that more than 800 people were executed by the ROK government in the second week of December alone. Many of these killings took place in the vicinity of Seoul, sometimes in full view of UN soldiers' encampments. The British, who had not been present for the first wave of political repression the previous summer, were particularly appalled. The eyewitness account of one British infantryman named William Hyder appeared widely in Western news sources. It read in part, quote, "A truckload of prisoners was shot less than 150 feet from the camp where the British were eating their breakfast. The guards led them in groups of 10 into trenches and then shot them in the back of the head. The women were screaming and the men were wailing. Some of the guards went around with machine guns, firing bursts into those who did not die immediately. I walked away when the kids were shot. I didn't want to see it." End quote. Syngman Rhee and other spokesmen of the ROK government vigorously denied that they had ordered the execution of children, and maintained that all these recent executions had been carried out with due process. Yet despite their protests, reports similar to the one read above only continued to surface. Another British soldier who chose to remain semi-anonymous went so far as to write to his representative in Parliament, quote, "Sir, I wish to report an incident that occurred at a place 3 miles north of Seoul in Korea on December 12, 1950. Approximately 40 emaciated and very subdued Koreans were taken about a mile from where I was stationed and shot while their hands were tied and beaten with rifles. I myself saw the graves and also one of the bodies as they were very cruelly buried. The executioners were South Korean military police, and the whole incident has caused a great stir and ill feeling among the men of my unit. I write to tell you this as we are led to believe that we are fighting to prevent such actions, and I sincerely believe that our troops are wondering which side in Korea is right or wrong. Also, my own feelings are so strong that I feel I must make known to someone in power of this cruel incident." End quote. Outrage among UN troops about the crimes against humanity committed by their ostensible allies nearly resulted in a disastrous collapse of the coalition. On December 18th, soldiers of the 29th Infantry Brigade of the British Army occupied a ridge near their encampment that had been dubbed Execution Hill for reasons that should be self-evident. Their commander, Brigadier Tom Brodie, ordered his men to open fire on any South Korean personnel attempting to carry out further executions on the hill. In other places, outrage turned into disillusionment, as many UN soldiers began to doubt the righteousness of the cause that they were supposed to fight and die on behalf of. With morale already critically low in light of the recent defeats and withdrawal from the North, these developments in the South threatened to break their spirits definitively. British journalist Renee Cutforth recorded the reaction of an Australian Army officer to the South Korean government's treatment of political prisoners that reflected the opinion of Western troops in Korea more broadly. Quote, "This, my God, is a bloody fine setup to waste good Australian lives over. I'm going to raise hell." End quote. This news produced a similar reaction on the home front as well. One Maryland resident wrote to the Washington Post, quote, "It has been said that the United Nations troops are now fighting in Korea to preserve, among other things, decency. Are South Korean massacres more decent than others? Those same South Koreans are imploring the United Nations to hold off the bloody hordes from the North. Why? So they can match, drop for drop, the quantity of mothers' and children's blood spilled? Surely some of my buddies are not fighting for this." End quote. The December massacres, as this renewed round of political repression became known, threatened to undermine the legitimacy of the South Korean government and, by extension, the United Nations as a whole. UN-affiliated diplomatic and political staff were anxious to get the situation under control. A cable from Washington, D.C. to the American Embassy in Seoul warned that the recent spate of executions was, quote, causing exceedingly bad reactions both here and abroad, end quote. They recommend that immediate action be taken to moderate the excesses of the South Korean government. At the behest of Ambassador John Muchio, a UN commission, the recently created United Nations Commission for the Unification and Rehabilitation of Korea, or the UNCURK, carried out an independent investigation into the matter that confirmed the reports of human rights abuses being committed by the ROK government. Faced with mounting international pressure, President Ri backed down. Following the recommendations of the UNCURK, Ri announced that he was suspending all executions pending an internal investigation and the court-martialing of individuals deemed to be responsible for the excessive killings. He offered further reassurances that he would work towards granting amnesty to most political prisoners, and that in the future, executions would only take place individually and not in groups. Ri's promises placated international observers for the time being, but as time went on, some recognized that they had no way of knowing whether or not the South Korean government was actually complying with these terms, or if they were still carrying out mass executions in secret. Some members of the UNCURK wanted to present a detailed report of their findings to the UN General Assembly, but this proposal was immediately shot down. The more pragmatic among them recognized that any effort to draw further attention to the ROK government's actions or to hold them accountable had the potential to jeopardize the war effort. The fact of the matter was that, as brutal as their methods often were, the UN forces in Korea had come to rely heavily on South Korean internal security forces to root out communist infiltrators and to secure rear areas against hostile guerrilla fighters. The head of the commission reached the conclusion that, quote, no advantage can be gained by an act which might weaken the international support now being afforded the United Nations effort in Korea, end quote. By accepting the verbal guarantees offered by Ri and his officials, the UN could effectively wash its hands of the whole affair, so to speak. Most of the UNC's military leadership, including MacArthur, agreed with the commissioner's assessment that the security of UN troops took precedence over any humanitarian concerns. The official line out of the headquarters in Tokyo was that this was an internal matter of South Korea, and as such, the UNC would refrain from taking any action. By February 1951, MacArthur felt that the public outrage had subsided sufficiently enough for him to impose official censorship on all reports concerning UN actions in Korea. For the soldiers who fought under the United Nations banner in Korea, Christmas Day 1950, December 25th, was a holiday marred by feelings of bitterness and disillusionment. The war was supposed to have drawn to a close weeks ago. They were supposed to be home by now. At least, that's what their commanding officers had told them, and that's what they had wanted to believe back in the heady days of that past autumn. As they tried to make sense of their dramatic reversal of fortune, many laid blame on their leaders who they felt had deceived them. In a report to the UK's War Ministry dated December 27th, one British war correspondent painted a grim picture of the current state of affairs behind UNC lines in Korea. Quote, it is nearly impossible for any man to retain a vision of the United Nations action in Korea as a great and essential experiment in international relations should he be subjected to the atmosphere of this country for very long. Inefficiency and squalor among the local population make some contribution to the overall feelings of disillusionment, but the major fault lies with the morale of the armed forces. The fact of the matter is that the men of the United States Army so completely dominate the scene numerically that their attitude is all important. It can be very simply expressed. How soon can we get the hell out of this damn country? That is the question on the minds of every GI and almost every officer below the rank of colonel. Half of them have no thoughts beyond the single objective of escape. Of the remainder, a few felt that it was a mistake, either strategically or morally, to cross the 38th parallel. Far more took the view that the United States should stop consulting with anyone else and just use the atomic bomb. They do not wish to see it used against the North Koreans, or even, at least to a great extent, against the Chinese communists. Their emotional reaction to the whole problem is that the Russians are primarily responsible for this mess, and therefore the logical thing to do would be to drop an atom bomb on Moscow. Offensive thinking among the junior officers and enlisted men is confined almost entirely to the Marine Corps. It was prompted mostly by a drive for revenge for the losses inflicted on them at the Chosin Reservoir, and was accompanied by a distrust and contempt for higher leadership that was almost more frightening than the lack of fiber among their army compatriots. There must be few occasions in history when officers and men of a fighting force have expressed themselves so freely and so violently on the subject of their own commanding officers. End quote. On December 23rd, General Walton Walker, commander of the U.S. 8th Army, was killed in a traffic accident when his jeep collided with an ROK Army supply truck on a narrow road north of Seoul. The unexpected death of the most important UN field commander in Korea drew mixed reactions. Had he died 1 or 2 months earlier, he would have been remembered by all as the fearless hero whose leadership played a decisive role in the successful defense of the Busan perimeter. However, in the weeks immediately leading up to his death, questions had been raised regarding Walker's judgment. Some criticized him for his decisions during the 8th Army's retreat from North Korea, which was characterized by many as a chaotic bug-out, especially when compared to the more orderly withdrawal of the 10th Corps. In particular, his decision to abandon Pyongyang without putting up a fight was widely considered to be one of the worst strategic mistakes of the entire war. At the time of his death, Walker was a man weary and on the brink of total exhaustion, something that was readily apparent to all observers. In fact, his superiors, namely MacArthur and Collins, had been considering having Walker relieved of his command. The top candidate for his replacement was Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway, a decorated veteran of the Second World War who had seen extensive action in the war's European theater. Ridgway was informed of his new assignment within hours of Walker's death, and he left for Tokyo almost immediately. On the morning of the 26th, he met with MacArthur at UNC headquarters. Ridgway and MacArthur's relationship went all the way back to 1919, when the latter was serving as the superintendent of West Point. The two had never been particularly close, which some historians attribute to their contrasting personalities. Unlike his high-strung and often theatrical boss, Ridgway tended to approach things in a highly practical, hands-on, and no-nonsense manner. He had an established reputation as a soldier's soldier, one who was unafraid to visit his men at the front and to put himself in harm's way. Emblematic of this was his signature habit of strapping a hand grenade to his uniform, which he claimed to do for a strictly utilitarian purpose. MacArthur's debrief painted a bleak portrait of the situation in Korea. In short, he was not at all confident in the ability of the UN forces to hold back the communist onslaught. At this moment, he believed that their best hope was Chiang Kai-shek and his nationalist army. He had recommended that the U.S. support Taiwan in attacking the Chinese mainland to open up a second front and relieve pressure on Korea, but the State Department rejected the idea. Foreshadowing his future conflict with the Truman administration that would lead to his dismissal, he all but accused the politicians in Washington, D.C. of being unwilling to do what was needed to win the war. Their indecision had left the troops on the ground aimless, without a clear objective. Since there was no willingness to escalate the conflict, MacArthur told Ridgway that all they could hope to do in the immediate term was to halt the enemy advance and push them back across the 38th parallel. He advised Ridgway to defend Seoul to the best of his ability, and barring that, to maintain a defensive position as far north as he possibly could, even falling back to the old Busan perimeter if it was necessary. At one point, Ridgway asked if he would be allowed to launch a counteroffensive should the opportunity present itself, to which MacArthur replied, quote, "The 8th Army is yours, Matt. Do what you think is best." End quote. The typically domineering MacArthur had not allowed any of his field commanders this degree of autonomy at any point during the war. This uncharacteristic concession was interpreted as evidence of his deteriorating mental state. Now, much ink has been spilled on the topic of MacArthur's psychology, and I'll have more to say on that particular subject in the next episode. For now, though, I think JCS Chairman Omar Bradley had some useful insights as to what was going through the general's head at this time. He speculated that MacArthur, having been humiliated by the Chinese intervention and feeling that events were no longer in control, was desperate to regain agency and to find any way to salvage a victory from this debacle, regardless of the consequences. Whether this involved expanding the war by directly involving Taiwan, or, as he would later propose, unleashing the unthinkably destructive power of the atom, MacArthur was willing to go to extreme lengths to prevent what should have been his final triumph from ending in a stalemate. Since he had correctly ascertained that the objective of the UN had shifted from reunification to the restoration of the pre-war status quo, he was willing to risk conflict with his superiors in order to get his way. In a dispatch to the Joint Chiefs on December 30th, MacArthur presented a sort of ultimatum. In his estimation, there were only two courses of action remaining: either to take retaliatory measures against China immediately, or prepare to withdraw from Korea and reinforce Japan. To the Joint Chiefs, the former course of action was unthinkable, while the latter was seen as only a last resort. General Ridgway was in high spirits when he arrived in Korea to assume command over the 8th Army on December 27th. He dismissed the idea of withdrawing to Japan immediately, but he also thought that MacArthur's proposal to widen the war was every bit as ill-advised. As he suggested during his conference with MacArthur, he had every intention to go on the offensive as soon as possible. After all, the UN forces still held a clear advantage in several respects. They still had unchallenged control in the air and at sea, they had superior equipment and more efficient logistical support. In his mind, there was simply no reason why they couldn't get back on their feet and turn things around. As he later recalled, quote, "My morale was at the highest of all time. I didn't have the slightest doubt that we would take up the offensive. It was just a matter of time." End quote. From the airport at Daegu, where he landed, Ridgway was taken to Seoul by jeep. After meeting with figures such as Ambassador Muchio and President Ri and offering them his reassurances that the UN would stay and fight, the general's next order of business was to tour the front lines. What he saw at this time did not inspire confidence. An overwhelming sense of doom and gloom had permeated the ranks. Most soldiers seemed rudderless, despondent, and thought of nothing else but when they might be able to return home. The attitudes of the officers were hardly any better. A letter sent by Private James Cardinal of the 5th Cavalry Regiment to his parents in New York City is perhaps illustrative of the demoralized state of the army at this time. Quote, "Dear folks, we are right now 60 miles northwest of Daegu, attempting to hold a mountain pass through which the entire 8th Army is now heading south. It looks like this is the beginning of the end. The Chinese are kicking the hell out of the U.S. Army, and I think we are getting out soon, or at least I hope so. I think they are going to evacuate all UN troops from Korea, seeing as how it's impossible to stop these Chinese hordes. There are just too many of them for us to fight back. If the bigwigs in Washington decide to keep fighting here, it will be the biggest mistake they ever made. When you get these complaining and bitching letters from me, remember that every other soldier here feels that way. The troops are mad. Mad at America, mad at America's leaders. We all feel that we've been let down by our incompetent, blundering leadership all the way from the White House on down. It seems to me, to hell with Korea. If we must fight communism, let's do it in Europe, which is the cradle of Western culture and of our own civilization. If you ask me, that's more worth fighting for than some barren oriental wasteland with uncountable hordes of savage warriors. It's about time you all back home awakened to the truth of the matter and let your voices be heard through letters to your congressmen. That's the only way we can get direct action. Well, folks, that's all for now. I'm in the best of health and spirits and hope that you are too." End quote. If these defeatist sentiments were as widespread as Cardinal claimed, then General Ridgway at least had his work cut out for him. His first and most pressing task as the commander of the 8th Army would be to revive the fighting spirits of the men that he now led. As he toured the front, Ridgway made a point to speak to the average soldiers, to listen to their complaints and concerns, and to make efforts to address them. For instance, when some men told him that they had been unable to write letters to their loved ones back home due to a shortage of stationery, he immediately placed a requisition order for more. Another common complaint was a growing scarcity of winter clothing, so Ridgway had begun to distribute extra gloves to the soldiers that he encountered on his tours of the front. His approach to leadership, small gestures like distributing supplies or remembering the names of his men, his personable and down-to-earth character, his willingness to put himself in harm's way, and to share in everyone else's hardships and so on. These things had a profound effect on men like Private Cardinal, who felt that they had been neglected and betrayed by those who were supposed to have their best interests at heart. Ridgway's aide-de-camp later described the general's style of leadership and reflected on why it was so effective. Quote, "If you had been a betting man, you would not have bet an awful lot on the United Nations forces at this juncture. A short summation of the situation, weather terrible, Chinese ferocious, and morale non-existent." The new 8th Army commander, General Ridgway, took hold of the situation like a magician taking hold of handkerchiefs out of a hat. He didn't turn the army around by being mean to people, by relieving people of duty left and right, by chopping off heads, or by striking fear. Quite the opposite. He breathed humanity into that whole operation. He effected gradual and orderly relief. He kept alive the old spirit of the offensive, the spirit of the bayonet, call it what you will. During the time that he was in command of the 8th Army in Korea, I can hardly recall half a dozen days when he was not under hostile fire. This impressed me very much. The troops knew it, and once they had got the idea that someone was looking out for them, and not for himself, the miracle happened. End quote. When it came to his officers, however, Ridgway took a more hardline stance. As a firm believer in the notion that one should lead by example, he was disappointed to find that most of his officers in Korea were failing to embody this principle. To Ridgway, an unacceptable number of officers were in Daegu, over 200 miles from the front. He ordered many of these men to relocate to advanced command posts closer to the battlefield. After having debriefed with the commanders of each corps and division, Ridgway began to purge officers whom he believed were most responsible for the recent strategic debacle. At one meeting with the colonel, Ridgway asked him what his attack plans were. When the colonel replied that no such plans existed and that there were only defensive operations planned, Ridgway relieved him of his command on the spot. Through actions such as this, the general wished to send a very clear message. The 8th Army was done retreating. He would lead them forward, not backward. At first, Ridgway's single-minded commitment to going on the offensive seemed foolhardy, and led some to refer to him as Wrong Way Ridgway. In due time, he would prove successful in reversing the UN's misfortune, and the once derisive nickname became one of adulation. Keen as Ridgway may have been to regain the initiative, recent intelligence reports suggested that the PVA would renew offensive operations of their own soon, most likely on New Year's Day, as they probably believed they'd catch their enemy off guard. There was no doubt that their primary objective would be to capture Seoul. Defensive preparations had to be made, and quickly. However, much of the army was still in a relatively disorganized state, and there was only so much that Ridgway could do about the situation in just 4 days. Anticipating that the enemy might be able to break through their lines, Ridgway had two of his corps form a defensive perimeter between Seoul and the 38th parallel to cover his army's retreat in the event that they had to withdraw from the capital. Ridgway's prediction was spot on. For the past month, commander of the PVA, General Peng Dehuai, had been attempting to convey to Chairman Mao Zedong the true scope of the desperate situation that his army was in, to no avail. Due to the ongoing logistical difficulties, the PVA was losing several casualties to starvation, disease, and exposure the further south they pushed. General Peng wrote to Mao, requesting permission to halt further offensive operations for the rest of the winter, but Mao was insistent that offensive operations resume no later than January. After extracting from the chairman a promise that the army would be permitted to rest and regroup soon, Peng gave the order to attack on the evening of December 31st. Following an initial artillery bombardment, Chinese and North Korean soldiers charged across the frozen over Imjin River, storming UN positions on the opposite bank. Once again, they concentrated their efforts on positions held by the ROK Army, specifically the ROK Army 1st and 6th Divisions, which held the line directly north of Seoul, and the ROK Army 3rd Corps, which defended the city of Chuncheon further to the northwest. Against a numerically superior foe, the South Korean defenses buckled. Entire regiments were routed from the field in a matter of hours. As the first day of the new year dawned, American aircraft relentlessly bombed Chinese positions, but all they could hope to do was to buy their compatriots on the ground enough time to fall back. By dusk on January 1st, UN defenses along the 38th parallel had completely collapsed, and General Ridgway issued the order to retreat. Here, he was determined to avoid a repeat of the 8th Army's big bug-out from the north. This time, the retreat was to be an orderly process where the troops would methodically withdraw from one defensive line to another, all the while maintaining contact with enemy forces. The first of these defensive lines was a bridgehead surrounding Seoul 15 miles to the north, east, and west. Taking to the radio, President Syngman Rhee addressed the citizens of the capital, urging them to remain calm and reassuring them that every measure was being taken to defend the city. The beleaguered residents of Seoul, who could clearly observe column after column of UN military vehicles rolling across pontoon bridges out of the city, and who could hear the sounds of battle inching closer by the hour, could tell that this was not the case. In reality, Ridgway had made the decision to evacuate Seoul on the morning of January 3rd. Earlier, one of his corps commanders, General Frank W. Milburn, ordered his men to defend the city at all costs. Ridgway immediately countermanded the order. With the city in imminent danger of being surrounded by an overwhelming number of enemy troops, Ridgway had determined that trying to make a stand in Seoul was practically suicidal. Instead, he would pull his forces back to a more defensible terrain south of the city, and once the front lines had stabilized, to launch a counteroffensive. For the time being, though, the top priority was to hold the enemy back just long enough for the army to retreat. For General Peng, this turn of events had been somewhat unexpected. In the immediate term, the best outcome he had hoped for was to inflict severe enough damage on the remaining ROK Army units to effectively remove them from the equation, and to therefore hamper the UN forces' ability to launch any sort of counterattack. Not even the typically overconfident Chairman Mao thought that the enemy would abandon Seoul so quickly. Having ordered the army to halt after the success of their initial attack on New Year's Day, Peng ordered them to continue the advance just a day later. As a mix of American, British, and Australian units fought a fierce rearguard action against the advancing PVA, the 8th Army once again faced an all-too-familiar predicament. A large proportion of Seoul's civilian population attempted to flee alongside the retreating UN forces. as many as 4 out of 5 residents according to contemporary reports. Military police guarding the pontoon bridges over the Han River were under orders to not allow civilians to cross. The only option left to the refugees, then, was to walk, slowly and cautiously, across the treacherous ice of the frozen river, which many were able to do successfully. As the final UN troops departed the city in the early afternoon of January 4th, new orders were issued to fully halt all civilian traffic in the direction of the army's retreat. Quote, effective immediately, no refugees, human or beast, will be permitted to cross the Han River, end quote. U.S. Army engineers demolished the pontoon bridges on their way out, but groups of desperate refugees still took their chances trying to cross the ice. At one point, American fighter planes strafed one such group, killing about 30 of them, and sending the survivors scrambling back across the ice into the burning city. Meanwhile, the first Chinese and North Korean soldiers cautiously entered the city, only to find deserted streets, abandoned buildings, and uncontrolled fires tearing through large swaths of the city, the result of enemy demolition crews. For the third time since the war had begun just 6 months ago, Seoul, the ancient capital of the Korean nation, had changed hands. The war was about to enter a new stage, but for the time being, I'm going to have to leave the narrative here. In the next episode, we will continue to follow the course of the war in Korea as it devolves into the stalemate into which it would be frozen. Then, we will shift our focus more to the diplomatic side of things as we cover the initial armistice negotiations and the difficulties that surrounded them. Hopefully, the next episode will be released in about 2 weeks as per usual, but as I've said before, it may be later. Again, it's my hope that this series will be over with by April, after which point I hope to start a new one with no further delays. Anyway, if in the meantime you have any questions, comments, or concerns you'd like for me to address, please don't hesitate to send them my way. I can be reached by the show's email, perspectivesinhistorypod@gmail.com, as well as on Facebook and the website formerly known as Twitter. Links to all of these can be found in this episode's description. If you like the show and want to help keep it going for the foreseeable future, you can help me out by becoming a supporter on Patreon or by purchasing some used books from me on eBay. Links to both sites will also be available in this episode's description. And that should just about do it for today. This has been the Perspectives in History podcast. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Will O'Connor, signing off.